general throughout the week will provide a special uplift to the soul of your father. Okay. We're up to Perek Chaf of the Tiferes Yisrael, the 20th chapter here of the Maral's Tiferes Yisrael, where he is discussing, in general, of course, this work is discussing Torah, in general, the quality and nature of Torah. And specifically, what we have to accomplish, what the Maral is going to try to accomplish in this Perek, in this chapter, is to discuss the relationship that the Avos, that the patriarchs had to Torah. The patriarchs, of course, were before the Torah was formally given to the Jewish people. The Jewish people were given the Torah at Sinai, and Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the patriarchs, lived before them, and so they weren't formally instructed to keep the Torah. Yet, we have certain pieces of Torah that are associated with some of the patriarchs, and we even have, to some degree, sometimes general statements about the patriarchs still maintaining Torah even before it was given. That's what we've been talking about for the last couple of sections. And last week, if you remember, when we did Perek Yotes, when we did the 19th chapter, the Maral began with two questions, and really I only focused with you on the one that he addressed in Perek Yotes, in the 19th chapter. Today we're going to focus on the second question, which is posed more fully in the beginning of the 19th chapter, and only briefly repeated here, but which this one is dedicated to. The Maral there had established that, you know, generally, you know, that when it came to, let's say, the mitzvah of Bris Milah, of circumcision, which was given to Abraham, and the mitzvah or the prohibition of Gid Hanasha, of not eating the sciatic vein that's in the thigh, which was given to Yaakov, to Jacob, that these mitzvahs were given to them, even though perhaps the totality of Torah didn't yet apply to them because they were not the nation. Remember the idea which he said, which is when you have the whole Jewish people, then you have the totality of Torah. When you, with the Avos, these mitzvahs were particular to them, particular to what they were trying to, what they were suited to develop within the Jewish people. Not going to go over what we discussed last week, but that's the general outline of it, which we're also going to use slightly as we go forward this week. So that was really addressing question two, why the specifics of the mitzvahs that we find with Avram, with Yaakov in those cases. But the other aspect which he deals with is, and that's what we're going to speak about more so today, is the way the sages spoke of the fact that Avram Avinu did observe all of the Torah, that Abraham did observe all of the Torah before it was given. If you remember, it was in the Parsha, the previous Parsha, in Parsha's Toldos, where Yitzchak was told about all the promises which he would have of Israel, etc. Ekev asher shama Avram bekoli, because Avram listened to my voice, vayishmor mishmarti, he observed my observances, mitzvosai, my commandments, chukosai, my laws, torosai, my toros. Now, for a person who hasn't been given anything yet, as we said, that's an awful lot, right? So it sounds like Hashem is referring to Avram Avinu really keeping everything, even things which evidently were not yet explicitly part of the mandate or part of the commandment of the Jewish people. And that's what the Gemara says in Maseches Yuma, that Avram Avinu kept the works. He kept everything. He was 100% observant of Torah. Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, Torah Shebalpeh, the oral Torah. There's even, the Gemara says that he even would make an Eruv Tavshilin, that special rabbinic enactment which we do on Erev Yom Tov that comes out on Erev Shabbos, right, to be able to cook on Yom Tov for Shabbos. Avram Avinu kept that too. So the Maral's question, very interestingly, is, why Avraham? Now, most of us, when we hear about this, our assumption is that all of the Avos, all of the patriarchs, kept the Torah before it was given. That's a working assumption which many have. The Maral, interestingly, doesn't accept that assumption with the full strength, with full strength. Maral says, oh, we find things. We find, for instance, that when Isaac gave the instruction to Esav to go to bring him some food, to bring him some game, he told him, Sana Kelecha, right? Which literally seems to mean carry your tools, carry your weapons, your instruments that you go to do your trapping. But the sages said, Sa is a term of sharpen. And he said to him, please make sure that they're sharp, so that you will perform the ritual slaughter properly. So evidently Yitzchak was worried about ritual slaughter. So one might say, okay, so that's an indication that he was worried about the totality of Torah. But the Maharal is very focused here on those things which are explicit. We can say, look, you talk about Avram keeping the Torah. You talk about Yitzchak worrying about ritual slaughter that he should eat kosher food. We're going to see, you talk about Yaakov Avinu worrying, it says in this week's Parsha, the week Parsha we're going to read this week, Vayichan es Pnei Ha'ir, when Yaakov came to Shechem, so he encamped outside of the city. So Rashi even quotes it, I believe, in his commentary in Chumash, but the Chazal say, the Gemara says, that Yaakov Avinu came there on Erev Shabbos. He came before Shabbos. At Shabbos, you know, you're supposed to have a fixed place for yourself for Shabbos. You don't travel around on Shabbos. Even if you're walking, you don't travel to all ends of the... Or you're supposed to stay pretty much in your same area. So that's what he did. He established for himself his tchum, his parameters, his place where he was going to be for Shabbos. So we say, okay, look, okay, so see, he did that. Probably he also, didn't eat unkosher food. And Yitzchak, who observed Shechita, he probably kept Shabbos, you know, like Yaakov Avinu did. And Avram Avinu, yeah, okay, him, it gives the whole list. Maharal's assumption going forward here, although the assumption will be tempered somewhat as we will go along, you'll see, but Maharal's assumption is that let's look at what it says. The verse says about Avraham that he kept mitzvosai, mishmarti, mitzvosai, chukosai, v'toresai, that he kept the works. It doesn't say that about the others. The Talmud doesn't come out and say it with that full strength by the others. By Avram, it was true. Why only by Avram? By Yitzchak, the verse tells us, or at least the way the sages read the verse tells us that he was worried about the ritual slaughter. Why was Yitzchak worried about ritual slaughter, of all things, if he didn't have all of the Torah? Why was that his thing? The verse tells us, the way the sages read it, that Yaakov was worried about Shabbos. Why was Yaakov worried about Shabbos if he wasn't having to be worried about everything? Okay? So if last week we spoke about the really obvious ones, which was Avram was given the mitzvah of Milah. When we have the mitzvah of circumcision, we have it from Avram Avinu, very explicitly. When we go to a bris, we say, blessed are you, Hashem, not only who commanded us to do the mitzvah of circumcision, but we also say, blessed are you, Hashem, who commanded us to enter the covenant of Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu is explicitly a part of it. The Gid Hanosha, the fact that we don't eat that part of the animal, right, that part of the hindquarters of the animal, it's because of the story which happened with Yaakov Avinu. There's no escape. That's what the verse says. That's why the Jewish people don't eat that part of the leg, because of the fight, which again is going to happen in this coming week's Parsha, between Yaakov and the angel. So those things are explicit. And we talked last week about what the connection was. But here, he's saying, let's look at the stuff which is a little bit more veiled. When it says, Avram keeps all of my laws, so our sages read that as literally all of the laws. Why by Avram does it say that he kept all of the Torah? By Yitzchak and Yaakov it doesn't say it. Why by Yitzchak does it say that he observed specifically one law, Shechita, ritual slaughter? Why by Yaakov does it say that he kept specifically one law, observing the proper area, the proper limitations of travel, so to speak, on Shabbos? This is what's driving the Maharal. And he has interesting discussions at the beginning of Perek Tes, back and forth, where the Maharal shows a little bit of his hand as a halachic master, not just as a mystical master, right, in those pieces. But that's the basic, that's the essence of what he's coming to explain here in this Perek. Yes?
Wouldn't that also be somewhat of a miyut of the Masorah, at least in those three generations, or two generations? Because wouldn't any of us be upset if our children didn't follow exactly what we were doing? We're doing 613 mitzvahs and they take up 612.
Okay, good. Right? If Avram Avinu did it all, what about his children toning it down and doing less? Now, what's going? Well, you know, how are we going to deal with that? So we'll see. Although the Maharal doesn't address that question per se, as the way you're phrasing it, but you'll see if it'll somehow emerge from what he's talking about. that we'll be able to have an understanding of that as well. Now, one thing which is important to note is that this is a classic question which was posed specifically about one specific transgression. What was the most obvious transgression that we had in the Chumash, in the Torah, committed by one of the patriarchs? Exactly right, marrying two sisters. Two wives is not biblically prescribed, but don't try that at home. It took the rabbis to forbid that. But two sisters is absolutely a biblical prohibition. Isha elachosa lo sikach litzror. The verse says you're not allowed to marry, a man's not allowed to marry two sisters. Jacob, in last week's parsha, what we just read yesterday, married Rachel and Leah.
Yours.
Now, again, what? Okay, very nice. So Avi's suggesting that because at that point they converted to join the faith of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, so therefore a person who's converted is considered basically like newborn. I hesitate to use the term born again because of associations, but nevertheless, that's the idea. It's kekatan shenola dami. It's like a new person, and therefore he would be perhaps separated from the relationships of before. That explanation is offered by the Maharal, especially in a very extensive comment which he has in the Gur Aryeh, in his commentary on Rashi, in Parshas Vayigash, which is a passage which is a twin passage to this chapter here in the Tiferes Yisrael. So anybody who is interested in Perek Mem Vav, in Vayigash, the Maharal has this major essay there where it enumerates the people who came to Egypt as part of the Jewish people, and it refers to Shaul ben Haknanis, Shaul the son of the Canaanite woman, and which alludes that he was somehow, his mother was a Canaanite woman. So who was that? So there's all kinds of discussions about who that was, and whether it was even Dina. Shimon married Dina because when he rescued her in this week's Parsha, so much from this week's parsha today, right? But when he rescued her from Shechem, so she said, "Look, what am I going to be left with? I was damaged by him." So he said he would marry her. Oh, he's marrying his sister, right? Again, so Maharal gets into a whole essay about this idea about the patriarchs observing or not observing the Torah, and he offers perhaps Avi's approach partially about marrying two sisters. However, the perhaps the most famous answer to this question was given by the Ramban, and the Ramban is actually not in this week's Parsha, but it's very relevant to something which happens in this coming week's Parsha. The Ramban says that Chazal taught us that the Torah was primarily given to be observed in Eretz Yisrael. The Torah is primarily given to be observed in Eretz Yisrael. That's what we say, that when we say in the Shema, that look, be careful lest your hearts turn away from God, and I'll send you out from this land. And then the verse says, and you should put these words that I'm telling you on your hearts and on your souls. So what does that mean? So the Sifrei, Chazal said, Rashi quotes it, and the Ramban quotes it, and makes a big cornerstone out of it in his commentaries. That the Chazal say, even though you're leaving Israel, keep the mitzvahs anyway. Why? Because that way, when you get back to Israel, it won't be like you have to start from scratch. You'll be familiar. Which means that somehow the Torah was really meant to be given for Eretz Yisrael. It's a fascinating thing, The Torah is composed of two parts, right? Torah is composed of two parts. What are the two parts of the Torah? Largely spoken, it has five books of the Torah, whatever. Right? But there are two aspects to the Torah. There are the stories of the Torah, and there are the commandments of the Torah. There are the stories and the laws. The first Rashi in the Chumash asks a question. Torah, the word Torah means instructions. So why are the stories even in here? Right? So Rashi gives a whole discussion that he says, the reason why we tell the stories is because the stories serve as the deed that the Jewish people would have on Eretz Yisrael. Because if you see how God created the world and how he moved things around to put people in position, to give the Jewish people the land when they deserved it, to change things when they didn't, so then when we find ourselves in Eretz Yisrael, nobody can say to us, what are you doing here? We're there because God allowed us to be here. Because you see, that's the whole turn of history is in order to make that happen. So the stories are there in order to affirm our right to Eretz Yisrael. And here we have, what are the mitzvahs for? The mitzvahs are only for Eretz Yisrael. So all of the Torah is only for Eretz Yisrael. The Maral, in fact, in the Gur Aryeh, when he explains that first Rashi, he says, but one second, is the question why tell us the stories? Aren't the stories important? The question is, why are the stories in the same book as the Torah? Says the Maral, you know why? Because the Torah is for Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, we want to put the stories, which is the deed for Eretz Yisrael, for in the same book as the Torah. Right? So that's what the Ramban says. That when we got to the Avos, while it's true they kept the Torah before it was given, but they didn't keep this like extra thing. They say, you know, keep it outside even though you don't really have to. They kept the Torah as the end game. The Torah was ultimately meant for Eretz Yisrael, so when they were in Israel, they kept the Torah fully. When they weren't in Israel, they didn't necessarily keep the Torah fully. So when did Jacob marry two wives? When he was in Haran. And says the Ramban, startlingly, that's what we have in this week's Parsha. On the way back into Eretz Yisrael, Rachel gives birth and she dies. Why? Because coming into Eretz Yisrael, now Yaakov would have to worry about the Torah. What was he going to do? He wasn't going to do anything. He would be passive, right? Hashem made it that Rachel died on the way to Eretz Yisrael, so that in Eretz Yisrael he didn't have two wives. Right? Wow. Right? That's what the Ramban says. The Maral, accepting in principle that the Torah is fundamentally for Eretz Yisrael, as I just mentioned to you, his comment on the first Rashi and the Chumash, but the Maral argues vehemently with the Ramban. He says, no. The Torah applies outside of Israel, doesn't it? Only agricultural mitzvahs are limited to Eretz Yisrael. So if the Torah applies for us outside of Eretz Yisrael, any assumption about the patriarchs keeping the Torah would be the way we keep the Torah. I think I can understand the Ramban. Personally, I would think, you know, but Maral very much is not satisfied with the approach of the Maral. Yes?
That's what I was going to say. There was the whole Sugi and Kedushin about this is to leave Aretz and which was handed to the Aretz.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's the chidush, that's the novel idea of the Ramban, that even though we are obligated to keep non-agriculturally based mitzvahs outside of Eretz Yisrael, but there it's not the ultimate place for it, for even keeping those. Okay.
Even by Isurim?
Well, not the ones which are Bnei Noach. Mitzvahs which apply to all of humanity, the Noahide laws, like the two examples which you just said, generally, not all arayos, not all forbidden relationships, but for instance, adultery, or marrying one's blood relatives, right, which would be considered, you know, pure incestuous relationships, that's forbidden even for non-Jews. Those are the Noahide laws. Those, of course, apply outside of Israel, too. Those apply just like they apply outside of the people of Israel, they apply outside the land of Israel. However, the mitzvah of not marrying two sisters does not apply to a non-Jew. The prohibition, that's not considered one of the arayos which are forbidden for Bnei Noach. So therefore, it's limited. It's a Jewish commandment. And yes, even as a prohibition, it would only apply, that's what the Ramban would argue, it would only absolutely apply in Eretz Yisrael for the Avos. For us, again, it applies every place.
So would that be Masha, according to Ramban, that Yitzhak then, in fact, kept the entire Torah and not like the...
That's again. The Ramban would be according to the standard, which is that they all kept all of the Torah. They all kept all of the Torah. Yes.
Rachel and Leah weren't blood relatives?
They weren't blood relatives of Yaakov.
Okay.
I mean, they were, but distant. They were cousins. I'm saying the fact they were blood relatives to each other doesn't forbid them to Yaakov. The Torah says a person shouldn't marry a woman and her sister, a woman and her mother, and so on and so forth. That's a different kind of an incestuous relationship than a person not marrying his sister or not marrying his mother, okay, where it's forbidden. That we learn from a verse in Bereishis where it says, "Al kein ya'azov ish es aviv es imo v'davak b'ishto." A person should leave his father and mother. In other words, he should leave his blood relatives to marry a wife. If he leaves his blood relatives and goes to a different family and marries a whole assortment of members of that family, he's still leaving his family to go and get married. So it's not one of the Noahide laws forbidding that, mm-hmm. but it's a Jewish law forbidding that. It's permissible. Whether it's a good idea is a question, but it's seriously, it's a real, you know, all kinds of genetic issues can exist as a result.
There's not even rabbinic prohibition on today. You can mamash do it straight.
A first cousin?
Yeah,
sure. Hasidic rabbis, by the way, do it all the time. If it's a Hasidic courts, they do that. They there's a lot of marrying amongst. Most cousins makes for very confusing wedding invitations. okay, so
the 12 Shvatim were already born. So why Hashem decided to take strange question? Rachel and not Yaakov. The all Shvatim were born. Yaakov was almost under, and Rachel was in her 30s.
Yaakov was just getting started in his work as an Av, as a patriarch. There are many things that go into the death of Rachel and the choice of Rachel. He's giving one factor. Mm-hmm. Yaakov's work wasn't done. Evidently, Rachel was very young, but evidently, this was the choice that Rachel's was. Mm-hmm. Okay. So back to our fundamental question. Which is first question, which is why would Avram Avinu be the one who keeps all of the Torah? Why would Avram Avinu be the one, which we could say according to everybody, that the Torah explicitly describes his keeping, his adherence to all of the Torah? Mishmarti mitzvayse chukayse v'seyreise. So the Maral has two basic approaches to them, both of which I think are profoundly beautiful and significant. The first one is as follows. The Torah wasn't given yet. So how do you keep the Torah if the Torah isn't given yet? You figure it out. You somehow intuit it. You discover it. You discover the Torah which wasn't given to you. Who was a specialist in discovering that which was not shown to him? That was Avraham. Avraham was the original. Avraham was the one who grew up in a house of idol worship. His father was the CEO of Idols R Us. Right? He had a big idol store. He was growing up in a house with Avodah Zarah, and we're even told that when Avraham Avinu was a child, he was on with them. He used to go to church with them, the rest. But he was sitting there in the pews, and his mind was racing, and his heart was not there. And he's saying, this doesn't seem right to me. This doesn't make sense to me. And through his own intuition, through his own searching, he thought and he thought and he discovered. And he discovered that, you know, there's this whole confusion. People started worshiping, you know, the sun and the moon and the stars, and they have lost sight of the first cause. They lost sight of God. And he searched even further, and he was saying, well, they did it, you know, they thought God was so remote. But he discovered Ki Amarti Olam Chesed Yibaneh, right, which was the real, real great addition of Avraham Avinu to theology, which was that he recognized that God created the world as an act of kindness and of giving, of chesed. Hiyomarti olam chesed ibanu. You know, I've told you, I think, many times that we have one psalm in the book of Psalms, in the book of Tehillim, which is attributed to Avraham Avinu. The Talmud tells us, the 89th psalm is called from Eson HaEzrochi, which the Gemara in Bava Basra says was Avraham Avinu, was Abraham. And what does it say there? Second line, Hiyomarti olam chesed ibanu. I said the world was built as an act of kindness. Avraham Avinu, nobody told these things to him. In truth, there were other people in the world who knew about God. Contemporaries of Avraham. Shem, the son of Noach. Aver, the grandson of Shem. I remember the Academy of Shem ve'Aver, that little place where people still believed in God and where people would go to study and where ultimately Yitzchak would go and learn more about God and Yaakov would go and learn more about God. Right, the beginning of last week's parsha, Yaakov Yerushava, he spent 14 years between leaving his father's house and going off to Haran to study in the house of Shem Be'ever. They knew it, but Avram didn't get it from them. Avram didn't have access to the house of Shem Be'ever. They didn't go. Shem Be'ever didn't go and recruit in the local high schools in Ur Kasdim. Right? They were a little corner of theology, of monotheism, of whatever it was, you know, to themselves. Avram Avinu discovered Hashem. Did Yitzchak discover Hashem? No. When Yitzchak was 8 days old, his father gave him a bris. Yitzchak had... Okay, he's saying, no, he was deprived of the opportunity to discover. But he was also given the opportunity of having a heritage of faith, to live off of his father's discoveries, to be able to benefit from that. Avraham Avinu, however, was the discoverer. You know, I love to say over what Rav Yitzchak Kuttner said, right, his characterization of the three avos. Right, it sounds much better in Yiddish, okay? So I'll say it in Yiddish, even though I don't think anybody around the table is going to understand what I'm talking about. Okay, but then we'll say it in English. Right? Avram is given the erste Gevorener, und Yitzchak the erste Geborener, und Yaakov the erste Farfallener. What does that mean? Avram was the first person to become a Jew. Yitzchak was the first person to be born a Jew. And Yaakov was the first person to be absolutely and unchangeably a Jew. You see, Avram had children that weren't Jewish. Yishmael left. Yitzchak had children that weren't Jewish. Yaakov, from Yaakov on, you're a Jew, you're always a Jew, you're never a Jew. There's no such thing as a person leaving Judaism. The person could stand on the roof of his house and scream and say, I'm not a Jew anymore. We don't say it. We're going to still consider him a Jew. Absolutely. So Avram was the first one to become, Yitzchak was the first one to be born as a Jew, and Yaakov was the first one to be Jew for life, never to be given up. So Avram was the discoverer. Avram had the capacity to discover Hashem. And so you talk about the Torah which wasn't given, that's Avram. To discover the Torah, to anticipate the Torah, to understand right and wrong before he was actually told what's right and wrong, not just to have it as a tradition, that's Avram. That was why for Avram that was real. For Avram that was real. Now you say, okay, so let Avram give it over to his children, like he gave over belief in the living God. But he didn't give over. You know, it was Torah was, again, as a commandment, it waits for Hashem to give the commandment, evidently. Again, you'll see, even the Maharal is going to countenance the fact that the others kept it too, to some degree. But to Avram, who's the Av of discovery, to Avram, who, the way the Maral phrases it, is Avram is miyuchad el ha-Torah shu ha-seichel ha-elyon. Avram Avinu was operating under seichel, under intelligence, under intuition and understanding and discovery, because he discovered Hashem after all. So he discovers the Torah too. I don't know, isn't that gewaldig? Isn't that great? It's like, well, it's very, very, very real. To discover it before it was given. That was the whole power of Avram, to work in a vacuum. Okay.
We have a question.
Somebody down there,
like, basically, what you're saying, it's understandable. Obviously, you hear it, it makes a lot of sense. But Lamaisa, the nuance of, like, you're just giving that to Shechita, or, like even the one you said about making
a Tavshilin.
Like, these things seem so... Like
the thought of them?
Like Sfaras from Rebbeim, and listen, like, he figured all that out. It just seems very hard to actually relate to that concept.
It is. I agree with you. It's hard to like, imagine the intuition process that produces, you know, every nuance and detail. Our intuition is very, very clouded. Our intuition is very clouded, really. I'm not saying a joke. The reason... the reason why the Torah even had to be given openly is because our intuition fails us, too often. Avraham Avinu really got it. He really got it. He was able to study, to discover, to understand. Look, think about it. It's not even, you even go back further, how when Moshe Rabbeinu died and certain halachos were forgotten, and Moshe says, Asniel ben Kenaz was able to reconstruct 3,000 halachas, and they said, oh, that's right. They recognized that he got it right? But he did it not through saying, now I remember. He did it with bipulpulo. He did it with intuition. And then they said, yeah, that's right. There's an intuition. Right? Our intuition is, yeah, I don't think it's right to rob that bank. You know, like we're doing pretty well, you know, at that level. But the intuition of subtlety, of nuance, of understanding every piece, it's much harder for us. Much harder for us. Avraham Avinu evidently had it. If there's anybody who had it, we say here, you know, there's some notion of giving it, of understanding it, observing it before it's told. Right? That would be Avram, the master of discovery.
Could it be the process that you hear about Mozart? They work very hard, but then suddenly there's this complete flash and he hears this whole symphony.
Yeah.
And all he's got to do then is work to get it down, but he gets the whole thing. He's impregnated.
Nice. I like the comparison.
You know,
very nice.
It's an act of genius or whatever, but
a flash of it.
He gets the whole thing and it's impregnated. Uh-huh. He's got to then bring it to into
okay.
Heaven.
Nice. Okay. So that's one aspect, as we said. Maral has two major thrusts to why Avraham Avinu would be the one to have Kol HaTorah Kula, all of the Torah. However, what's the second? The second speaks to what we spoke about, what we alluded to, Avraham Avinu's great connection to Chesed, to kindness. Avraham Avinu discovered that God's creation of the world was as an act of kindness, a fundamental kindness of giving, to give people the opportunity of living with a godlike existence themselves, creating them in His image, to experience the ultimate good, that God was about goodness, about kindness. And of course we know that Avraham Avinu, one might say it takes one to know one, Avraham Avinu is storied for his kindness. And Avraham Avinu, 99 years old, he just had a circumcision, a bris milah, it's a brutally hot day, and he's sitting by the door of his tent looking, is there somebody I can give a meal to? Is there somebody who's going to be traveling despite this heat that I'll be able to take care of? Avraham Avinu is chesed li Avraham, is characterized by chesed. Says the Maharal, what's the Torah? The Torah is chesed. The Torah is kindness. What do we say in Eishes Chayil, in the song for the woman of valor? Pia pascha bechachma v'soras chesed al lashona. Her mouth opens with wisdom, and the Torah of kindness is on her tongue. Torah is called Torah's chesed, the Torah of kindness. Chazal taught us, our sages taught us, that the Torah begins and ends with kindness. Literally, in the beginning of the Torah, Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, eat from the tree of knowledge, and suddenly they realize that they should be really wearing clothes. Well, what could they do? They couldn't go to Kmart, right? So what did they do? So Hashem made for them, kosnosor vayabishem, Hashem dressed them, it says. He gave them clothing, an act of kindness. A person who doesn't have clothes, He gave them clothing. The last act of the Torah, Moshe dies, right? And what happens? But he went up to a mountain. He went up alone. There was no accompaniment. Hashem told him, go there, die on your own. Who's going to bury Moshe? Hashem, God, buried Moshe Rabbeinu. It's another act of kindness. It's taking care of the dead. The ultimate kindness, some days that we say, is to take care of the dead. Who? There's nobody going to be there to pay you back. The middle of the Torah's kindness, when Avraham Avinu was ill, recovering from the bris, Hashem went to just be with him. Bikur Cholim, visiting the sick. So we say the Torah begins and ends and has kindness in the middle because the Torah is all kindness. What do we say every time we read from the Torah when we put it back into the Ark, into the Aron Kodesh? Derocheha darchei noam v'chol nesivoseha shalom. The paths of Torah are paths of sweetness. All of its roads are of peace, of peacefulness. They're all about being good to other people. Everything in the Torah is about goodness and kindness. So who gets Torah? Avraham Avinu, whose personality is chesed, he gets Torah, whose personality is chesed. It's not just God is kind, and He gave us all these weird rules, right? Because somehow it's an act of kindness. He is kind. The Torah, which is identified with Him, is filled with kindness. And He gave it to us as an act of kindness. And the more that we ourselves are sensitive to kindness, the more we're going to understand what the Torah is talking about. And Avraham Avinu was so well attuned to chesed, to kindness, that the Torah to him was just natural. He understood it. And to him it was compelling. Before it was just given as a set of laws for a nation. He understood its core. He understood chesed, the ultimate good of chesed.
Was it a process for him through his life? I mean, did he kind of get it, like, like the aha moment initially, or was it like
The way the Chazal described it, it was definitely there was a process.
Mm-hmm.
There was a process. When he was already a few years, 3 years old, he had questions.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When he was older than that, some even have it that when he was already in his 40s or 52 years old, right, he really came to his understanding of Hashem. Certainly it was only at that point that he started sharing the Torah with other people and teaching the Torah to other people. So Avraham Avinu did himself have a process.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, we trace the 10 challenges of Avraham Avinu. Those were 10 challenges Hashem posed him, which was for the growing experience of Avraham Avinu. At what point did he understand all of the Torah, whether that was a process or that was a moment, that I can't tell you, I don't know. So this is what he says. And I would just want to remind you, he alludes to this a little bit here, the Maharal in his writings here, but I would remind you he says, I'll tell you the lines which he say here, and then I'll remind you of what we learned in the Be'er HaGola a long time ago. He says, Af kasher timtza b'torah misus u'krisus. You know, the Torah is not all sugar and spice. Right? In the Torah, it has punishments, consequences for negative things. So we say, oh, the Torah is just so sweet and nice. Says Maral, Ein tachlis ha-Torah rak la'amid ha-Torah ba'olam, sh'le'yin nimtza shum ra. Says, yeah, even when the Torah does take, so to speak, what would be seen as harsh steps, they're necessary harsh steps in order to maintain goodness. That's the way it is. It's a difficulty for a good end. So let me remind you here, which, you know, of course, we all understand that sometimes you have to do that. Right, it's the person who's always going to be nice, 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 nice. We'll create delinquents. Right, we'll create, people who know no boundaries and end up not doing them any good or any kindness whatsoever. But I want to remind you of a very important and beautiful maral which we learned in the Be'er HaGola. In the Be'er HaGola, where one of the sections is dedicated to explaining halachos, laws of the Torah, that seem to be a little bit counterintuitive. So one of the rules, which the sample rules which we have over there, which the Maral discussed, was that there's a fascinating rule which says that if a person comes before the Sanhedrin, comes before the high court of the Jewish people for a capital case, and it's not the Dixon trial, okay, what happens is that it's a slam dunk for the prosecution. The best in the Sanhedrin, everybody says, he's guilty. Take him out and chop his head off. If that happens, we don't take him out and chop his head off. If there's some dispute, and there's a majority that says his head should be chopped off, we'll chop his head off. Or whatever it is, whatever this prescribed punishment might be in this specific situation, if all the conditions are met. But we will not carry out in exactly the same case, right? If there's a, you know, if this guy, you know, if this guy stands up, right, in front of a stadium and pulls out a gun, and there's no Zapruder film over here, right, and he goes and he holds it to the temples of the fellow in front of everybody, and he blows his brains out, and there are 100,000 witnesses, right, and it was on national television, and they come to the Sanhedrin, right, and they testify, and everybody says, forget it. And before he did it, you know, they warned him. They said, do you blow his brains out? You're liable to a death penalty. He says, I know, exactly. And boom, he does it. He comes to the Sanhedrin. No debate. No debate. What do? We don't kill him. But if it's, whatever his name is, on the grassy knoll, and who knows, and what's happened, and it came from here, it came from there, right? And the Sanhedrin looks and considers, and the witnesses, and so on and so forth, and they decide by a vote of 42... to 29 that he's guilty, we'll kill him. Does that make any sense to you at first glance? To me at first glance it doesn't. Counterintuitive. Why should that be? When it's absolute clarity, that's when you should kill him. When there's doubt, that should be when you would say, I don't know, there's doubt. You know, you need to have a unanimous jury in our law. In American law, I should say. So the Maral explained very profoundly, I think. Maral says, you have to understand, yes, Sanhedrins give a death penalty. They kill a person when he needs to be killed. But why are they doing it? Because of goodness. Okay, now that might sound a little patronizing, but no, it is the actual, absolute, it has to be reality. If it wasn't a good thing, if it wasn't part of Derecheha, Darchei Noam, V'chol Nesivos Seh Shalom, all of its paths are paths of sweetness, and all of its roads lead to peace. If it wouldn't fit under that, they couldn't do it. They wouldn't do it. How does the Sanhedrin show that they're not just a lynch mob, that they're not just out to kill? How do they show their goodness? They show their goodness by all the laws which are built into the rules of the Sanhedrin, which says, look and see if you can find innocence. Yes, the Sanhedrin is much more slanted to not punishing than to yes punishing, than to punishing. Why? Why does it have to be that way? Because otherwise, one might see, even within this case, just a desire for vindictiveness, for punishment. So it's not that when the Sanhedrin unanimously votes that we're not sure whether he deserves the death penalty. Well, of course, we're more sure than ever that he deserves the death penalty, perhaps. But you have lost your right to act as the Sanhedrin if someone can look and say, this is just a lynch mob. This is just people who like to punish. The fact that there are people arguing the other side shows the presence of tov, of goodness, of kindness within the Sanhedrin. And then they can be the Sanhedrin. That's what you're taught over there. Yeah, of course there are laws of the Torah that have an edge to them. But they have to be far from that world of chesed, of kindness. And there we have that dramatic chiddush, that dramatic novelty, that it's not just some, trust me, the Torah is a kind thing. We've got to see here, and we've got to see now, the kindness at play, active in this case, in order to be able to go ahead and do that which indeed doesn't seem to be kind. Parenthetically, there's a big lesson in that to anybody who's in a position of ever having to discipline anybody. If you want the person, your child, who you're disciplining, to say, oh, you know, he really loves me, you know, but you know what, look, this time I really did something wrong. It's not enough the fact that you bought them a late model convertible last week. In the action, there has to be visible kindness. When the Sanhedrin gave a death penalty, they killed the guy, and they did it in a way which was most painless. Why? Because there's a mitzvah of v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, you should love your fellow man like yourself. If you would have a death penalty, how would you like it done? The Talmud has a debate as to when they would throw, one of the methods of killing, right, now this might sound wonderful, hope you enjoy your breakfast, is throwing a person down a rocky mountain, stoning, right? And then if he's still alive, you throw a couple of boulders afterwards just for good measure. Skila, death by stoning. So the sages had a debate, how should we stone him? Should we stone him clothed or unclothed? Why? Maybe we should stone him clothed, because he should, in addition to the death, he should suffer indignity of being thrown down there without clothes on. On the other hand, if he's dressed, so whatever he's wearing is going to be something of a cushion, and it could prolong his death by a few instants. So maybe it would be nicer if we said, you know, forget the dignity thing, let's make this as quick and painless as possible. Which one would be better? Can you imagine? Who cares about his dignity? Who cares about a few instants? Right? Just do whatever it is. Let's figure out what's worse, not what's better. No. The Sanhedrin has to have, as the characterization of their punishments, even when they're inflicting the worst punishments, you have to see the goodness. It's a lesson for us. Again, if we ever have to discipline, if we ever have to say a harsh word, don't rely on the fact that what's in your heart, and don't rely on the fact that you've done a lot of nice things for this person in the past. It has to be built in. The kindness has to be visible. Otherwise, not only may the person not realize it, but it may indeed be that right at this moment you're being harsh. Right at this moment you are being harsh. You were nice last week, but now you're in a bad mood. Right? No. When you discipline, you have to be in a good, kind mood. You're in a good, kind mood, and nevertheless this tells you to do it. That should be visible on the spot in what you're doing. Okay. back to the morale of the story. So what does he say? Says the morale. So Torah, which is chesed. Avraham Avinu gets Torah, which is chesed. He says beautifully. That this is what our Chazal meant when they spoke about the Torah being written originally as Esh Shchora al Gavi Esh Levana, black fire on white fire, instead of black ink on white parchment, black fire on white fire. Pre-creation, the Torah to somehow black fire on white fire. What does that mean? Black fire on white fire. So Maral says, first thing you have to know is that when we speak about the Torah being placed on fire, it's because what our sages are telling us by that is something that we learn about many times here in the Maral, is that don't think the Torah is just like this practical thing. Okay, I created this world and you have these societies and you got to figure out how to make these things work, so let me tell you how to make it work. Then the Torah isn't placed on fire. Then the Torah is on parchment. It's on something hard and something fast, something physical, because that's what the Torah means. It's meant to impose order on the physical. When we say the Torah's backdrop, what the Torah is placed on is white fire, we're saying that, of course, the Torah is to some degree going to be imposing some order into the material world, right? But the Torah also is there as part of establishing a spiritual reality. Al gavi esh levana. Its context is ultimately to create something which is beyond that. Okay, so that's the fire. White fire is because lavan, white, white is always the sign of that which is good and pleasant. Right? When we looked at the partial question, we point out, you know, Yaakov Avinu goes to deal with lavan, white, right? Lavan is, he looks nice, he's so friendly and wonderful and engaging, right? He makes it look white, right? But that's the idea, that it's on Esh Levana, which is the whiteness, the goodness. What's the Esh Shchaira? What's the black fire? Oh, it's not red fire, right? Red would be, red implies, you know, negativity and evil, like in the case of Esau. You know what, when we say black on white, what do we mean? We mean absolutely clear. So we say the Torah, yes, it's in a backdrop of chesed, but it's also with absolute clarity. So what's that? Says the Maral, these are the two names that we have for the Torah. One name for the Torah is Torah's chesed, the Torah of kindness. What's the other name that we have for the Torah? Torah's emes, the Torah of truth. So the white fire is the kindness, the Torah of chesed. The black fire is the clarity, is the Torah's emes, the Torah of truth. So, who's going to ask? So, what's the next question?
Who's bigger?
More than
you guys are too sophisticated. I want a plain question. Well, it's also a little sophisticated question. So, Avraham Avinu, we say, is most connected to Torah because he's chesed, and Torah's chesed.
Yaakov.
Oh, Yaakov, Jacob, the third patriarch, is associated with Emes. The same verse which says Chesed LaAvram, kindness associated with Avram, says Emes LaYaakov, truth associated with Yaakov. So if that's the case, so then if there's Torah's Chesed making Avram Avinu so connected to Torah, why isn't Yaakov so connected to Torah because of Torah's Emes? Very simple, straightforward question. Right? Once you have the very complicated assumptions. Says the Maral, and I wish he would have gone more to bring it back, but what the Maral's essential answer is last week's shiur. Remember last week we talked about how Avram and Yaakov had these two mitzvahs? Avram had the mitzvah of Bris Milah, which was go to take something from this world, which we would consider perhaps to be the most this worldly thing in this world, right? The circumcision takes place on the part of the body which is the sexual part of the body, the part of the body which is engaged in sexuality. And and we go and we have a mitzvah on that. We go and we make a bris and we include it in the covenant with Hashem. Avraham Avinu went to any part of this world and he converted it into a mitzvah project. He made it possible to be purified and to be somehow included in the relationship with Hashem. Yaakov, what was his mitzvah? It was in the same part of the body. It was on the thigh. Right? But his was the thigh that gets hobbled by Esav. And we said, because what happens with Yaakov, what he's doing is, he's talking about, but there's that part of the world which just, I cannot reconcile with goodness. There's that part of the world which is just, I can't make it godly. Yaakov Avinu, remember, what are his comments to some degree about this world? Oh boy, did I have a rough life in this world. Right? This world, I had so many bad things. Yaakov Avinu, oh, he's a person of truth. But because he's such a person of truth, when he looks at this world, he says, what is this place? It's a world which is full of so many things which are the opposite, it seems, of truth. Bad things happen to good people. Good things happen to bad people. Where's the truth? Yaakov Avinu is not the master of integrating the physical world into the realm of the spiritual. So, of course, we have this great irony. When we speak about Torah, we say, the world stands on three pillars. Kindness, Torah, Avodah, and Milas Chasadim. Avram was Chesed, was kindness. Yitzchak was Avodah, was worship. Torah, that's Yaakov. Right? Emes is Torah. The Torah was given to us. Right? Right? The Maral alludes, right? The Torah is given to us in the third month. Right? In the third month. And to a people of threes, right? Kohanim, Levim, and Yisraelim. A Torah which is of threes. And of course, right, the other pieces through, right, in the Schus, in the merit of Yaakov, who was the third patriarch. Right? It's all because of Yaakov, because that's Torah's MS. Yaakov is so attuned to truth. But to observe truth in this world? No. He doesn't see that. To him, that, there's a great gap between absolute truth and this world. So many things in this world militate against truth. Remember that famous Medrash which says Hashem was creating the world. So what happened was, right, Emes, truth said, you can't create this world because it's full of falsehood. So what did Hashem do? He threw away the truth and he created the world. Right? He threw the truth down to this earth is literally what it says. And he did it. Right? There's so much in this world which challenges pure perspective of truth. So that Yaakov Avinu would be in this world keeping the Torah exactly? No. It's not that he... It doesn't work here. It does not work here. That's why. Chesed! Oh, chesed works here. The whole world was built because of chesed. The world was built despite truth. The world in its form was built despite truth. But it was built in its current form because of chesed, because of kindness. So Avram Avinu of chesed, Torah's chesed, it's alive and snapping in this world. Torah's emes, not so fast. Not so fast. There's still a gap, a distance that has to be traveled. So yeah, Torah's both. It's the fire which is black, the clarity of truth, on the fire which is white, on the backdrop of goodness. The backdrop is more visible than the writing. Yeah.
To take the atmosphere, to take the truth view, does that require a perspective that takes the afterlife, that takes the world to come into consideration also, so that it becomes a view that encompasses truth, but one that isn't limited so directly to this world, but which includes the next world as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The way to answer to ourselves all the questions about what's going on here, why are the bad things happening, is because we understand we're seeing a small part of the picture. We're seeing a little snapshot. Seeing a little snapshot. It is, excuse me for using old and tired examples, right? But it's like the person who gets a snapshot of the surgeon standing over the operating table, right, with a knife and a saw, right, and you know, digging into the body of this person, and not taking a step back and looking at, you know, the anesthesiologist and the prophylactic antibiotics and the rehab and therapy floor which the person's going to go to afterwards. You see a little snapshot and you say, this is crazy, right? You see, you know, the whole picture, and then you understand that it's truth, right? But sometimes, you know, when you're in this piece, it doesn't go. You know, that's, you know, there's a beautiful Sfasemis. He formulates it, I think, the nicest. On Yaakov, right? Yaakov goes and he has to steal the blessings, right? He deceives his father. He says, I am Esav, by his mother's encouragement. I am Esav, give me the blessings. Right? Yaakov of truth. He lies? How could that be? Right? So says the Sfasemis. He says, what Yaakov was practicing was something which one has to practice with great, great care. Great, great care. Don't. Like many people will take this and run with it, right? Yaakov, you know, remember, he was resistant. He was afraid to do it. His mother said, you have to do it. Yaakov said the following. Okay, I want to give you my favorite example for this, okay? Excuse me. Pause for favorite example. Your name is Goldfarb. Okay? Your name is Sam Goldfarb. You're living in New York in 1941. And somebody comes over to you and says, Mr. Goldfarb, I need you to do something for me. Actually, not for me. I need you to just plain simple do something. Says, what? What do you need me to do? He says, here, I have an affidavit here. There's a family in Warsaw. Their name is Goldfarb. They are going to die if they stay in Warsaw. Poland is going up in smoke. I have an affidavit here that you can sign that says your cousins, the Goldfarbs, you want them to come to America and you're going to be their sponsor. Sign this. I have passage booked for them on a ship that's coming over from Poland at the end of the month. I'll get this to them and they will be out and their lives will be saved. Now, for you to sign that affidavit about this family in Poland that you never heard of, that not only may not be related to you, but they're definitely not related to you. You know why? Because you were one of those guys when they came to Ellis Island, right? You said your name was Goldfarbrovsky, right? And they changed your name to Goldfarb, or whatever it was, right? Or you came from Russia, right? And the rule was that that one child of every family has to go to the army, and therefore, you know, you were the second child in the family, whatever it was. So you went to a childless family, whatever. You know, all kinds of reasons people change their names. You got people, oh, are you related to so and so? No, that's not really our family name. Your name isn't. You know, you're not related to them. So you have one of two reactions. One reaction will be, I'm sorry, I can't sign that. I'm not related to them. And it's against the law in the United States. You know, the United States has laws, very strict immigration laws, and even greater limitations. The laws were beyond laws, right? They weren't even keeping the immigration laws which they themselves, the stingy immigration laws which they had created, they were also undermining and not keeping. But look, it's the law. I can't do it. I can't sign it for Mr. Goldfarb. That's one option. The other option is you sign it and you save these people. Who is a more truthful person? The one who signs it or the one who refuses to sign it? Says the Sfasemis, the one who signs it is more truthful. Why? Because the one who refuses to sign it, he's saying, it would not be true for me to sign that I'm related to this man Goldfarb. And therefore, that man Goldfarb should be killed by the Nazis. That's truth? That's right? You have to understand that in our world, we have truth with a small t, and we have truth with a capital T. Right? When our sages say that, you know something, if your wife makes dinner, right, and she says, honey, how's the stew? And you personally, if she would look the other way, you would clutch your throat with both hands, right? 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 But you know, and the sages say, you know what you say? You say, honey, the stew is delicious because for shalom bayis, for good family relationships, it's worth lying. What are they saying? That's not the truth? No, they're saying that there's truth with a small t. Truth with a small t is, was the soup good or was the soup not good? Truth with a large t is, you love her, you want to have peace together, you want to have that together. That's real truth. That's the real person of truth. Not the instinctive person of truth says, oh, I can't say this, it's false. No, it's where your eye is on the bigger truth. That was always what was necessary, to have a big view, not a little view. So the person who signs it, he's the one who's perpetuating the truth. Says the Sfas Emes. I mean, this is what we all understand. So Yaakov Inu could be very honest. He'll say, I'm going to go in there, he's going to say, what's your name? I'm going to have to say it's Yaakov. And therefore, what's going to happen? Yitzchak, who is deluded to some degree, and thinks that Esav should have the blessings, so he's going to say, I'm sorry, I can't give the blessings to you. I'm going to give the blessing of controlling the world, of controlling you, to that fellow, who I think is nice, but you know is evil. Evil. Terrible, 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 terrible. So you will walk out, click your heels, and say, I just stood up for the truth. You didn't stand up for truth. You had a narrow, small t truth that stood in the way of pursuing big t truth. Now again, I know everyone can abuse this and say, oh, I'm going to cheat on my income taxes because I have to feed my family, and you know, and so on and so forth. You know, and I'd say, this is small truth, this is big t truth. So don't try this either at home. Right, you gotta be very, very, very careful with this principle, but you also gotta understand this principle. Right, you gotta understand this principle. Right? I don't know if those of you who were here on Tisha B'Av, I'll just remind you that I told you about Irving Bunim, who was centrally involved in pushing these affidavits in front of people named Goldfarb for people who they didn't relate to get people's lives saved. And Irving Bunim was a textile manufacturer. Or a textile, in the textile business. And there were rules at the time of the war about quotas and price rules, you know, 25 cents a yard or whatever it was. And there was a black market galore of people doing it. And he was offered, right? He bought some fabric. He had fabric, 25 cents a yard. A fellow came in and said, I want to buy your fabric. I have to make mattresses. He says, I'm willing to pay you $1.25 a yard. I'm willing to pay you $1.25 a yard. He said, no, I'm not going to take it. I'll sell it to you for 25 cents a yard, but you have to promise me that you are going to use it. You are going to use it for what it says, and that you're not going to turn around and sell it to somebody against the law for a profit. This guy said, he paid him 25 cents a yard. He walked out. A fellow offered him, I don't remember anymore the amount, like $7.50 for a yard of the fabric. And he said, I can't. Bunim said, I have to use it. I can't do it for more than 25 cents. So this man, who night and day was breaking the law, was suddenly so faithful to the law. You know what the answer is? The answer is because signing an affidavit to save a life named Goldfarb is truth. Even though it's not small t truth, it's big t truth. But making money, when there need to be price controls for a war effort and so on and so forth, what's big T truth about that? It's not. So there, absolutely, we're going to keep it exactly the way it says. When you know that your compromises on small T for the sake of big T aren't spilling over into compromises on T altogether, then you know that you're really a man of truth. Says the Sfas Emes, Yaakov Avinu's perspective was, Sheker letzorech emes emesu. A falsehood, a small falsehood, for the sake of a big truth, is truth. Says the Sfas Emes, this world is called by our sages Alma de Shikra, world of falsehood. What's the world to come called? The Ilam HaEmes, the world of truth. It says if a person lives in this world with an eye to the world to come, to the big picture, then they're living in a world of falsehood, but for the sake of truth, and they could make this world into a world of truth.
The danger of that is the means justifying the end.
Absolutely, that's what I say. That's what I say. Don't try this alone. People can always do it. But is it true to say the means never justify, the end never justifies the means? Right? Of course. Anyone can abuse the idea of the end justifying the means. So therefore we should reject it in its entirety? Nobody would.
Very cautious.
Nobody would. Very cautiously, very carefully. But to just be saying, look, this means doesn't seem right, forget about it. We're not going to think about what the ends which it comes to accomplish. That's not morality. That's not right. Yeah.
If someone's looking at the muscle, that someone looks at the surgeon and he's on top of the person. So is the idea that we're given in this life, as the, I guess, I don't know, the nimshel to the muscle, but intentionally things are supposed to look kind of like someone who's glancing at the surgeon at that one instant. And we're supposed, our goal in this life is to know that there is a bigger picture. Like basically that, it's set up that way to grant us free will. Is that the idea?
That with the fact that we naturally only see the small picture and we have to take a step back to see the big
right.
picture?
Like that, is that the test of life?
That's certainly part of the test of life. That's the idea of Olam Helem, you know, that this world is a world where a lot is hidden. You know, you have to broaden your view in order to quote unquote get it.
But one could argue that seems unfair. In that someone's just going to see the surgeon on top of them. Right, so the world is created in such a way that you don't see what's under
it. It's not unfair. It's not easy. It's not easy. You need to discover. You need to look. You need to. It's not like instinct, just there. Hashem expects us to be discriminating.
Just a little confused on one point. The Maharal was making. With his proof about the Torah and the world from earlier class, this whole thing was that, you know, it's not the the manual to the car that people can just figure out, that the Torah is there for us to, that was the whole reason for that, we can use the Torah.
Shem has to give the instruction, huh?
Right, but that with Abraham you were saying that he did him to it, so obviously we're not on the level of Abraham, but he's spending a lot of time now saying but the whole purpose why Avram got it was that he actually just intuited a lot of the, you know, the chesed of the Torah. But yet, for everyone else, he's saying that the whole purpose, that, you know, that the Torah can't come to the world that way.
You're right, and your point is correct. And to some degree, I have sinned. In other words, I put a tremendous emphasis on the intuition. Despite the fact that the Maharal in this particular section, you know, consistent with his before, he's not talking about that as much. But his idea is, since Avraham Avinu goes and works to discover without being told, the idea that he sort of extracted the Torah from Hashem before Hashem told it to him is suitable to Avraham Avinu. Before Hashem put it out there as a tzibur, is it just he gets it by himself, intuition, does it need help from above? He doesn't march down that path as much as we did.
Okay.
As much as we did. But the idea of, again, searching and finding it before it's thrown at him.
We're talking about how Avram kept the whole Torah. If, I don't know if this is just like looking for trouble, but we see that, I guess, Avraham and Yitzhak both had the, I guess, stealing das, and I guess the Gemara says that's specifically related to non-Jews. When he went down to Egypt, and the Philistine talking about his wife was specifically doing a deception. Is that
any of us does, huh?
Yeah.
Again, when Avram, everything Avram Avinu did there was exactly like Goldfarb.
Okay.
It was like Goldfarb. They did it because what should they do? They should be honest, and then what's going to happen? Then they're going to get murdered, so that their wife should be taken. Congratulations, you were an honest man. Yeah, that's sheker, that's sarach emes. Deceit for the sake of a real truth, an ultimate truth.
Rabbi, is this false emes in parsha todos?
I think so.
So Yaakov, you need an emes, like his tests have to be big T, little T tests. That
yeah, that's right. All of his tests are like that. The whole Lovin thing is big T, little T.
So how does it go back to Avram and Donah?
No, not Avram and Donah. Avram is chesed.
Right.
Torah's chesed is comfortable in this world. Yaakov is emes. Yaakov could have Torah's emes. Torah's emes is not so comfortable in this world.
So the
So
of Torah is
the Eish Chayra would not just come by itself. Yaakov Avinu recognized how distant this world was from genuine emes, so his connection to Torah, because of Torah's emes, was not necessarily going to be applicable in the here and now. Emes isn't here.
So that second piece does not relate to Avram.
No, that's not Avram. Avram Avinu's connection is through Torah's Chesed, and Yaakov Avinu's connection is through Torah's emes. Because Avraham Avinu's connection is to Torah's Chesed, it can be in this world in the fullest sense.
So the answer to the question is, how does Torah's emes relate to Avraham? The answer is it doesn't.
Oh, that wasn't. I mean, well, that wasn't exactly the way we formulated the question. The question was, if Avraham Avinu is having Torah before it's given, because one of the appellations of Torah is Torah's Chesed and Avraham is Chesed, so then why doesn't Yaakov have Torah in this world? Because one of the appellations of Torah is Torah's emes and Yaakov is emes. Okay. And it says because Yaakov is emes, but not in this world.
Got it. Okay. Anyway.
Another way you could say it also is that the word chesed doesn't